Hey, this is John Bokenkamp. Welcome to The Blacklist Exposed on Golden Spiral Media.
It's a comic event of epic proportions. Welcome to The Blacklist Exposed. I'm Agent Troy Heinrichs.
And I'm Agent Aaron Peterson, here to talk to you about C2E2. Everybody's been asking us, and now we're going to tell you what happened. Show notes and other intel for this episode of The Blacklist Exposed can be found at where? TheBlacklistExposed.com.
Wow, we just had an awesome time down in downtown Chicago at C2E2. You know, this comic convention, I mean, granted, we're here to talk about the Blacklist panel that we did, which was phenomenal. And some of our people have already seen it because it was streamed live on Facebook and is up in the Blacklist Exposed Facebook group. But this convention itself, I mean, almost 80,000 people come to this thing. It is ridiculous how big it is.
The event is phenomenal. It's been growing every year. I think we've only been there for like 3 years now.
Seven, I found out.
Has it been 7 years?
I didn't realize seven. That. Yeah, I didn't realize that either.
It's growing near the size of San Diego Comic-Con, which I haven't been to in a year or two, but it's, and I should preface, it's not as big as San Diego Comic-Con. I'm just saying it has grown exponentially. So the event has become huge, and you see fans everywhere. Fans of Star Wars, fans of Star Trek, fans of The Blacklist, fans of Lord of the Rings. I mean, fans of every kind of fandom are at this event, and they are actually treated with respect and treated with dignity, and they're all just there to be with each other and get excited for whatever it is that they're excited about. And it's a great event, a really great event. And we had a great time with the panel. It was great seeing many of you that are listening, as well as obviously John and Amir and Susan.
And Susan was a big surprise. A lot of people thought Harry was coming, Harry Lennox, and unfortunately he had some shooting responsibilities. So we surprised him at the last minute and brought Mr. Kaplan to them front and center. I think some people almost passed out when they saw her.
Man, could it have been better timed? Honestly, that Susan came, Mr. Kaplan showed up right after the biggest episode, I would say, of her entire tenure on The Blacklist. And people were just losing their minds. They were super excited. And it was Susan's first time, actually, Susan Blommert's first time at a convention. She had never done one before. And I mean, you could tell she's a little nervous, because why wouldn't you be? I mean, I was nervous. Weren't you nervous a little bit? The first minute, I was a little nervous. Then it gets kind of calm, and she molded into it.
You kind of fall into the routine of, okay, we're just talking to people, we do that every week, this is fine, no big deal. Sure, they're looking back at me, but we're good with that, you know. What I loved about it, though, is, I mean, these are some of the stories you won't hear on the actual audio, because the audio is just from the 1 hour of the panel itself. But the team, right, John and Susan, Susan was like so fascinated by the concept that she wanted to actually go walk the floor down in the masses, the 80,000 strong, to see what this thing was all about. I just thought that was really, really cool, because it just shows how down to earth, you know, John, Amir, Susan, really everybody that's involved with the show that I've met so far, just how down to earth they are. They're like, they're not pretentious Hollywood people. Like, I got to go, you know, get in my car and nobody touch me. They stood around for a good half an hour after the panel, signing autographs, taking pictures. I mean, just truly really, really great people all around. So yeah, it was just cool that they were down on the show floor. I thought that was pretty fantastic that they took the time to do that. And of course, people stopped them. And I wonder how many people thought if she was actually in cosplay or the real person.
I'm sure there were many who thought both. Yes, it was fantastic. And I will tell you that, you know, having interviewed actors and directors and the like before, I honestly, spending time with these guys, Amir and John and Susan, they are, Troy's not wrong, they are some of the most down-to-earth people in Hollywood entertainment that I've met. And honestly, I was very impressed with how genuine they are as people, how lovely they are as people. In fact, everyone with the show we've talked to, Hisham, the same way, Megan, just a joy to talk to. I mean, just everybody involved has been just extremely humble and delightful and entertaining as hell. That panel, they rock this panel. What you're about to hear, their panel, was fantastic. They did a great job. And just keeping things entertaining, keeping things moving, keeping things enjoyable. They love this as much as you love this. I firmly believe that. And that is proven just by how they rocked this panel. They just rocked. I don't know what else to say. They rocked it.
And Susan specifically at one point, for this being her first panel, she was on point. You'll hear Amir a couple of times go literally all over the map in his explanations and answers. And this one point, he's just like talking about old girlfriends and situations. And Susan literally grabs the mic away from Amir to get him to stop talking and just keep digging himself into a hole. The whole room just erupts when you hear that part. So when you hear that on the actual playback here, you'll understand why the whole room is laughing.
Yes, absolutely. It's hysterical. And also, I want to give a shout out to Carolyn for helping put together a great event. And also Kathy for being just a delight to talk to.
With that, here is the fan panel from C2E2 in Chicago. I hope you guys enjoy it.
First up, we love the Blacklist and all the characters of Raymond Reddington and his baby Crosby. Could be maybe daughter. We don't know what's going on. But Liz Keene, we want the answers. We want the truth. This is the man, the creator, John Bogenkamp. The FBI is not that different. We all know him alum is around, the hacker with a heart of gold, Amir Arison. And last but certainly not least is an actress with an extensive career. We thought we lost her earlier this season, but now Mr. Kaplan is back to clean that red stain out of the carpet. Susan Flowers. To talk to Blacklist?
Yes.
Okay. Susan, Mr. Kaplan's been busy.
I haven't been very busy.
How was that for you? Has everybody seen the latest episode? Because you're about to be spoiled.
The latest two episodes.
Latest two episodes. Oh, sorry, shower guy. Latest two episodes.
When you start with the shower.
You can only get one out by Kaplan. Maybe Kaplan.
So how was that for you? That's a big shift in character.
It's a shift. It's a big shift. And I'm not sure what gear we're going to get to. She's over 5, I think. Down the road. We're going to have to go down the road.
And this is your first panel, am I not mistaken?
This is my first panel.
So give her a big round of applause. Great stellar work on the show. Stellar work. But we want to know one thing about Amir. Because we saw the bomb on Aram's table, and I just wanted, and when you were hanging out with Janet in the shower, how method actor are you exactly?
I do a lot of preparation. I took a lot of showers, and I like that you asked about the bomb. Actually, it's a little. You always pick up the Easter eggs, as John calls them. There was some bong and some beers on the table. Aram is known not to partake so much in drinking. He has smoked and joint before, which we talked about for a long time. But I think, this was a return episode, so where was a gap in time? And before that gap, two big things happened. It was 4:14 and 4:15. 4:14 was the architect where Aram shot a missile gun at a bad guy. That's a huge event in the universe of Aram. He doesn't fancy himself a murderer.
Was he high at the time?
My point is he got high after. he probably and couldn't deal with it. Actually, this thing's related to Samar, too. Samar was always like, he did the right thing, as if it's no big deal. And I was, just stop, I talked too long. This goes back to Gaia, actually, which was 404? 404, where he couldn't press the button after he hijacked the helicopter to stop Gaia from sort of starting the nuclear reactor meltdown. He hijacked the thing, and Cooper did it, and then Samar said to him, you made the wrong call. And then Aram said, well, Mr. Cooper didn't think so. And I think that really stuck with Aram, because he can't hurt a fly, but he didn't prevent all his deaths himself. So I think that between 404 and 414, he got to a place where he could press the button or pick up a missile that and fire it. And also, I think, as you know, he was firsthand witnessing all those deaths that the architect was doing literally right in front of him, blowing up the prison, killing people in the convention. So it was really, Aram had to stop it immediately, and he knew he had already participated and by indirectly helped him, you know, that far along in the episode. So I think that was, but once it was done, you go back to who your character is, and your character is probably had a meltdown. I mean, after the first time you killed someone in season one to protect Liz, this thing called Aram's notes happened where he had to start seeing a therapist to talk about his feelings. So I think that is why he maybe also fell into a thing with Janet again when she said, "I'm sorry." I don't think he was looking for a big romance. He needed for some release and started drinking and smoking and having fun, which he doesn't really allow himself to do in order to deal with the death. And right before that, I get into this. I'm sorry. Reddington was almost killed. And so that stressed him. He was literally on the verge of death at a cliffhanger, and it looked like Dende did it at the time of that episode. So this is a lot to deal with. He's re-examining. He's not getting along with his dear, sort of complicated love there, Samar. So that is why there was a bone meat table.
Short answer.
I thought it was just because it was 420. All right, well, John, serious question. This panel is called Inside the Blacklist, so we want you to take us inside. Tell us a little bit about the Blacklist, how it's evolved from your original concept when the show began 4 years ago to where we are now. And does knowing you have read a character that people will love no matter how despicable he acts, does that afford you a certain creative freedom in that journey?
Well, in terms of how it's changed, I think our cast has sort of, we've gotten to know them better and they've grown up, and the show is, in a way, an ensemble show, even though Reddington is the center of the show, and sort of always will be. We've gotten to know the other characters, like both Mr. Kaplan and Aram, and all the characters. We've had a little more real estate to get to know them. So I think that's something that's different. It's interesting. I can't tell if we're more serialized or less serialized than we were before, but it feels like there's a lot of serialization, you know, to the show. And that's all I can remember from your question. What else?
Tell us about the journey. It's been 4 years. How has the journey changed from when you started to where you are now? I know the basic association with Red and Liz has remained the same, but how has the show evolved throughout the years?
Well, I think one of the things that has changed is us understanding how to write the show. I feel like, you know, whether it's, I was just talking to somebody about, you know, Spader's long speeches or the sense of levity or comedy, the way that we infuse that, whether it's with Glenn from the DMV or, you know, whatever, some of the gags and the stories that Reddington tells, you know, we've got a real sense of who not only he, but all the characters are, and I think that is, it's not that we didn't know in the beginning, but it's like these little moments like Aram having a bong in his apartment or Mr. Kaplan completely turning, you know, on Reddington. Those are things that you sort of discover as you go along, as you get to know the characters. And there are moments, there's the occasional call where you'll say, I don't know if this is quite right, or I don't know if this is quite what Aram would do. And that's great, but we feel like we usually get pretty close. But we do get caught up, and we do occasionally stray. And there's the occasional phone calls and the conversations, not only with New York and the people who produce the show there, but also the cast, in terms of just making sure it feels true. And so there's a little bit of a balance between discovering the character and keeping and making sure you're saying, you know, staying true to that character. And I think that's something that really is what's changed. I think we, as the writers and I think the cast, understand the show better than we did in the beginning.
Can I add to that?
Please do.
This guy is so collaborative. We're shooting the finale now. I'm not going to give anything away. I called him about one tiny Aram thing. I don't think this gives too much away. There's like one line where you learn Aram has a pet. And I called him because I was like, I think it's a different pet.
Yeah, but let's do that. Let's just reveal that.
No,
I don't think that's too big of a spoiler.
Is it?
What did you say?
It's out there now.
Ron, there was a gag that Ron had a cat.
No.
And he calls me and he's like, I don't think that's right. I don't think it's right.
But Ron has a cat.
But you know what I think he has?
It's true.
I think, I think he has a turtle.
And I'm like,
That's
a great example of what I mean, where we feel like we get to know the character, we're writing for the character, we're revealing something like he has a cat, and then the actor comes back and says, let me help you a little bit with that.
And it's better.
He was so sweet in the middle of all this finale stress that he has to go through writing notes and everything. He read my 2-page email explaining why I think it's a turtle.
That's
going to
be published.
There are very good reasons, but if there's time later.
There's another element, though, to sometimes you get a script and you read it and you think, how am I going to do that? And it becomes, for an actor, the challenge to come up and make real something that you go, how am I going to get there and be true to who I want with? And that's a lovely challenge for an actor to try to figure out.
And there's a lot of
and you'll be the judge to see if I did it right.
She did. But there is a lot of trust in that. And you guys, I mean, they get scripts the day before they shoot sometimes, you know. And they're very late. We're notorious for being a little bit late in rethinking and rewriting the scripts. And so there is a tremendous amount of trust between the cast and production. You know, production will call us and we'll have a car crash or something that happens, and they'll say, well, we can't do a car crash because of the streets, but we can do an explosion, and so we'll reverse engineer the scripts a little bit. So we'll reverse engineer the scripts a little bit to help production and to help, you know, they're like, we're in New York, we can't take off a helicopter from downtown, you know, and so there are constant little adjustments that are happening, and that's what's part of the fun about making the show. That's part of the magic, is like there's a little bit of winging in it.
Yeah, a lot of winging.
A lot of
it. How is, and not to go back, but the Despicable idea.
Okay.
In terms of Robert Renton, he's a very bad man.
Right.
And or woman, we don't know. So but my question is, does that afford you a certain amount of creativity to just taking random chances that you couldn't do with other characters because he's so
biased
in a way?
100%. I mean, that's one of the things that makes writing for Megan, and I think makes the show fun, is that he's a bad guy, so there's a certain amount of wish fulfillment in what's happening, in what he says, in the way he reacts to people, in the way that he goes through his life. You know, it often becomes very violent, and more violent sometimes than I would like, but that's also part of the show. I remember we blew up Alan Alda, right? We had like a TV legend on the show that we were lucky to have, and it was a joy to have him every time we had him. But you go, well, I think that's where the story has to go. That's what would happen, and so that's what we follow. And that happens often with Reddington, where, for example, shooting Mr. Kaplan at the beginning of the season, we were stuck in a situation where, oh my God, we have to deal with this in a way in which he would deal with it. And he's been very clear about loyalty and betrayal and friends, and it felt like there was only one way he could deal with it. So at times that can be very difficult. At other times it can be incredibly liberating to have him just pipe off at somebody, or to, you know, draw his gun, or to handle the situation in ways that I often wish I could handle, but then I kind of chicken out and walk away. Then he can do that, and that is yeah, exactly. But it's very liberating in a way, and it's also in a way difficult.
Susan, what's it been like for you? Because you're on the other side of the law, based on earlier, you were a judge. I don't know how many times you've been several judges, and now you're gonna. You're in the bad. You're the big bad. How does that feel?
I have been on the side of the law many times, but some of my favorite things to do have been the bad things, or the evil. It's always more fun and more interesting to be evil than to be good, let's face it.
Yeah. It's okay to be good.
And it's okay to be good if you're fun.
Okay, well, this goes to both Amir and Susan. For both of you, you both actually were pretty lucky to have both of them here, because you're both characters that have gotten expanded roles, and in large part because of how you played them, as well as how the fans reacted to them. So how does, have you been surprised by any of your characters' journeys, and are you shocked by how popular you are, honestly?
I just want to thank everyone in this room for wanting me to have a job. It's been a great show. It's an amazing group of people to work with, from the top to the bottom. It's an amazing crew, amazing production, producers, everything. It's been a joy and an education.
Education how?
It's been an education in... I've learned a lot from James. He's an amazing actor. He's an amazing actor to work with. You learn a lot just playing with him. I mean, I'm old and been around a long time, done a lot of stuff, worked with really great people. But he raises the bar. That's been great in education.
How about you?
I consider the moment I got cast, and I was just talking about this with John and Susan. There was the director of that episode, it was Wu Jing, it was the third episode of the series when I started. The director of that episode became one of our producers and encouraged me to have fun and make it my own. And I threw in an ad lib just because I hadn't even seen the show. I was on a flight the next day back to LA, and I started to interrupt, but there's hardly any ad lib. There's no ad lib on the show. On a network drama, it's like every period and comma is scrutinized. I didn't know. I was like, the director said it, and I was like, and it did it at the end of the scene so it could be excised, it could easily be cut. And actually, when I saw it, I was at my sister's house, and I saw the scene, and I was like, I rewinded it. I was like, Maya, come here. They kept that. They don't ever keep
it. It was good. We were like, yeah, that's better than what we had written, so let's.
So, and then I heard that and it was kind of in my natural improv voice for that character, and then that's where the character really was born. I consider that moment one of the great miracles of my life. I could get emotional about it. I'm really grateful that happened.
Yeah.
And you know, I always wanted to be on a series. I always wanted to be on a quality series. I moved to LA because I thought I could be like Ross on Friends. And I ended up being Ross on The Blacklist. It was awesome. We air at the same time slot. Ross, when you get to do drama, I mean, I get to have some fun, but I get to do some comedy, I get to do some drama, I get to work with like the greats, James and Susan and. I certainly never expected it. I mentioned this earlier. I thought my function is, once I got on the show, to just kind of be an ancillary character who just sort of helps the computer aspect of solving the cases, and maybe throw in a joke here and there to throw some levity. And I really thought that. I remember Joe Carnahan, who was our original director, and I did an episode with him. He was like, no, make the character like this. I was like, I thought I'm just supposed to be this goofball. And then they really, really spoke to me about, like, this is a real guy, go for it. It's season 4, and I got a love triangle. I had to shoot a missile.
There's a sex symbol, by the way.
Say what?
A little bit of a sex symbol, too, by the way.
And they're Comic-Con geeks. I have one of my first little scenes with Susan coming up in a few episodes, which I never really had a scene with Susan. We were just talking about that. So, okay.
Well, now that I know where she is, that kind of worries me a little bit.
You don't.
Okay, so John, we're coming back to the mothership here in a few, but we want to ask about Blacklist Redemption.
Sure.
Okay, and it was 8 episodes of Tom Keene and Scotty Hargrave, with Tom ultimately siding with his father, Howard, for a pretty shocking reveal. Hopefully everybody caught that. What were the challenges and rewards of doing the spinoff, especially while you're doing the flagship series?
Right. Well, you know, look, we just felt like we had an opportunity to do more TV, you know, and it seemed fun. And Tom felt like a character who has a past, who's a guy who can become anybody. But what would happen if he were to try to, you know, try to go undercover in his own family. And that just felt like an interesting idea. It was an opportunity to do something that was a little bit different from The Blacklist, in that it's a little more fun, a little sexier, a little more heisty, a little less, you know, I think of The Blacklist as a crime drama, and Redemption is a little bit more of a spy genre, spy thriller. And truthfully, the hardest part of it was keeping the stories straight, keeping them linear, having them be faithful to both shows, because Redemption is a little bit of, well, what we didn't want to do you know, The Blacklist Chicago, you know, or The Black, although that would have been great, you know, that would have a complete duplicate of The Blacklist with, like, some other criminal who turns himself in and works with another team, that just didn't feel like it would work. And it felt like it would crimp from The Blacklist too much. And so we feel like it's an expansion of that, of The Blacklist universe. The secrets and truths and all of those have to match up, and it was very difficult. We did 30 episodes of TV this year, and that's a lot. And to have those characters leave and come into the other episodes and to sort of exist in both worlds was very difficult. It requires almost a bigger pie chart or map or graph than we already have. So it was, you know, scheduling and all of that. We'd have, you know, Megan scheduled to come in and she was seeing one scene, and they're like, well, we can't do that. We need her on The Blacklist, and this is the only day. And so the schedules were very difficult. But also just it was interesting and difficult and fun to create another world that felt like a little bit The Blacklist, but was not trying to be a duplicate of The Blacklist.
Were you saying that DeMont was doing your job?
Interesting fact. is it okay if I say, yeah, there was a draft of The Architect, which was the episode where Aran went undercover, that DeMont was in.
Really?
And there was a really fun, but again, just like you said, production demands didn't allow the two shows to shoot. So the end, I think it ended up being, you know, there's always sort of like when there's one problem, another door opens. So I think it ended up giving more real estate to, more show real estate to Janet, Elise, and Aram, right, too, a little bit. So that ended up being extremely cool too.
That's a good direction. That's a good example of that, of where you sort of vibe it out and find your way through it. You know, that was, we thought, oh, DuMont is a character that's going to be on this next show. I love Adrian Martinez. He's one of those guys that I watch movies and I'll have my laptop next to me. I'm like, oh, who is that? And I'll have a little draft of just actors that I see and I think are fun. And he was one of them. And we thought, well, why wouldn't we involve him and have him come into an episode and be a little bit of a shout out to people who knew about that spinoff of the embedded episode. And it didn't work. And yet, because of the schedules, and had it not worked, we wouldn't have been able to have Elise eventually took over that role, Elise slash Janet.
And I was okay with that.
Yeah, that's it.
Well, share a bit about how you broke the season down, especially since Kate's death happened so early in the season. From where we are now, were there any ideas that ultimately just didn't stick? Should we worry for Red and Liz? Because some of these truths could really impact them.
Well, yes, you should worry for that. I mean, yes, there are... as far as one thing we knew we didn't want to do after having Liz fake her death, we knew that we couldn't fake Mr. Kaplan's death. And we didn't want Mr. Kaplan to go away, and yet we felt like we knew he had to deal with her in a significant way. And so there's actually a shot, if you watch it, where you see her hand move just barely, which is sort of our shout out to say, she's not really dead, you're with us. And don't think that we're killing off a character and then later think we're going to come back and be smart and say, no, she's really alive. So we were sensitive to that. And feel like, moving forward, I think what's great about her sort of catharsis and where her character is she's so dangerous to Reddington. I mean, as we've seen in the episode that just aired, she's so intertwined in his past. And sort of the origin story of the show. And so that gives us a really great bad guy that is unlike anybody we've had before. And it's incredibly threatening to Reddington, and it's very real to him that this woman can damage him beyond repair, you know? So I think we're in a really great place with the show. I think we've got a really compelling story.
Was that hard for you, Susan, to know that you were gonna eventually go up against him? Or is that exciting?
There's a little bit of both, because I think there's such a fine line between love and hate. And I think that that's a line that was crossed, but it doesn't ever go away. So it's a hard road to walk, but I think I'm right.
How did you like having your own biography episode, by the way? And kudos to Joanna for playing you. She was. You both were great, but she definitely mirrored your inflections. And
no, she was. I was saying earlier that Joanna and I have both been in New York as actors for a long time, and we never really knew each other, but we spent probably many hours in many waiting rooms to go in and audition over the years. And so when I found out she was doing it, I was thrilled because I've seen her work and I know how good she is. But I have to say that I was just telling them that I have some sisters. We all grew up in Chicago, by the way. And one sister called the other and said, "Did you see that still shot of they said it's young Kate. Is that Susan?" I was like, "That's my sister's asking this question." I think she did a good job.
She's
fine.
So how is that for you to know that you're going from sidekick to basically big bad, maybe eventual blacklister? I mean, that's a big arc for you this year. Has that been intimidating?
It's been exciting. On occasion, I'd say a little intimidating, yeah. But then you just go, okay. It's what I was talking about before. How am I going to find this place to go to? That's an acting thing. But I find it fascinating, and I think, you know, we're in good hands. We're in good writers' hands, and so you trust that. You trust they're taking you to a place that's a logical, true place to go. And so as long as you can go there, you'll be all right.
That's interesting.
Or not.
Yeah, no, we're not. But the feeling is mutual. One thing that's interesting about the show is that, you know, our writer's room's in Los Angeles, and so we're at Paramount, and that's where an editorial is there, and production's in New York, and there's a weird disconnect. And we don't really go to set, you know. I've been there a couple times, but we don't spend a lot of time sending writers to set. We write these scripts, and we ship them out, and they come back, and like I said, sometimes pieces are changed, or locations are different, but the intent is always the same. The scene, the tone is always right, and I'm always surprised at how they're better. You know, they come back. The scope of the show is very big. It's an incredibly difficult show to shoot and produce. When we were doing the spinoff, there were times where we were shooting four episodes at one time. You know, two of Redemption, two of Blacklist, and I'm always surprised at the sort of visual scope that the show has, that the production's able to land on. Nick Lundy, our set designer, who does incredible. I mean, we have a show where the main character doesn't go on our only set. You know, Ren doesn't go in the war room very often, and that makes it very difficult. And from what the cast does to what Dave Porter, who does the music, who's fantastic, does to the editing, you know. I have the pleasure of being able to see how terrible the idea was in the very beginning, and we try to make it something that we think will be fun, and we ultimately land on a script very quickly. But by the time it's over, I love watching the final mix of the episodes where the VFX are in, the music's all mixed, the color timing is done, and I go, oh my God, how did this happen? It does feel like a movie every week. And you get to see, for example, the episode that happened on Thursday night, the beekeeper aspect of it, I was watching dailies. You should have seen this stunt woman. There was like three guys in like full bee costumes and a stunt woman standing there in basically pants. She was basically topless. And the guys are like shaking these bees out, you know, and they got these brooms and stuff, and they're stinging her. And that's the scene. Oh my God, yeah. She's like, when the scene was over, they're like, she's like, they're stinging me. And the guys who were like, you know, they're like, okay, keep rolling, we got the, you know, like trying to get the best, you know, whatever. And the stunt kind of guys come in, they're sweeping the bees off. Now there's VFX that were added to that to make it even more, but I'm like, oh my God, we wrote that, and I thought that would be really cool to see, like, the weird bee lady. And then I go, oh my God, somebody's there actually having to do that. And it's a pleasure. So it's I'm always fascinated by how it's brought to life. It's interesting that you kind of have to look at it and go, how are we going to get there? But it always somehow happens.
Don't they have computer effects for that?
Well, you know what? They do, and some of, when we use some of them, what they did is they made a corset, a sort of shirt out of little bees. And if you watch the dailies of it, it's just, it looks ridiculous, you know? And the VFX are, one, incredibly pricey, and two, take a lot of time, and we're on a very short turnaround. So oftentimes the stuff, that's why so much of the stuff is practical on the show. Explosions, you know, I saw a thing on New York News where we got in trouble because, like, we blew out windows of some apartment building because we had blown up something in a neighborhood and people were upset. And it's like, well, it's not VFX, we're really doing these things, you know, so it's just because of the time.
The church where Tom and Liz were supposed to get married and then got shot up by Mr. Solomon. The exterior was shot on location at a church, at a small, adorable little church. And the interior of a church was entirely built, because it was a big location, on our soundstage, so that it could be shot up, exploded, and basically destroyed. So there was...
It's really incredible to see it and sort of come to life. The words on the page are one thing, but it's really fascinating to watch. And it's become a very well-oiled machine. That's one thing that has changed. When you talk about how the show has changed from the beginning to now, there's a lot more trust with the studio and the network, but there's also a lot more trust with New York and just knowing what a scene should look like, what it should feel like.
Amir, Ron and Samar have an unrequited love, which is... Well, maybe they still do. And we were all kind of mad at Samar for like a New York minute until you took up with Janet again. And I don't know where we stand yet. But props to the show for making that triangle work, by the way, because that can go south pretty quick, and it still works. It works well. How has that been to play for you? Do you think Saram still has a shot?
I love this question. Get ready. I'll talk. I just got you and I'll say too much. No, Joey Walker, shout out to EW, once said, she's a writer for EW, and I mentioned this to John the other day. She once said, she goes, I'm starting to get the sense that, you know, I don't know if it's Samar and Aram are will they, won't they, or are they a can they or can't they? Which is something a little different. You know, our show is a little darker. It's not Friends. It's not Ross and Rachel. And I really like that. And a lot of times me and Mojan talk about, like, they'll get us into a situation and I'm like, I do not know how these two are going to get out of it. Of course, two episodes later, like one act later in the show, it's like, oh, okay. So much happens in, like, between commercial break. I alluded a little bit earlier to how I think Aram got back with Janet, but there's an important thing that happened in the last episode, which it sort of seems like Aram, there's two sort of big moments for Aram and how this went. I need to like map this out. Okay, I want to talk about her wanting to quit. I want to talk about Aram not wanting her to quit, then they not getting along. When she said she was going to quit the task force, there actually was, I hope it's okay, there was a scene where Ron like, pitched her not to quit, but it didn't make it into the final cut for various production reasons. You know, John said something really interesting. He's like, it's very clear in your character that you don't want her to quit, even if you don't say so. And so then when she says... she's like, I actually turned in my resignation, but you heard Janet was there, and he said, congratulations. Not what he felt. Aram always kind of says the wrong thing to Samar, often. She took that like, what? You're not going to stop me? And it's like, well, I tried to. I don't know how to talk to you about this. And then they started picking on each other, and they get in a fight, and they're far off. Then Janet comes in, and it brings them closer together.
because Samar kind of saves him from getting his ass whooped in the wonderful banana scene. So jump ahead to the architect. Oh, then she goes and works with Massad and basically lies to the task force. Similar goal to get Salva and Hassan, but she completely lies to the task force and specifically lies to Aram's face when he's like, let's try that. And it was right when he had just asked her out on a date to celebrate getting over the deposition. So are you all following me? They watch the show. So right after that, it's very, you know, and she also almost died. It's very weird thing that you have to imagine. This has to happen. When somebody almost dies that you love, and you couldn't help them because they're lying to you, and they just lie to your face, no matter how you feel, and no matter how much you understand their intentions, you might need like a second. Like if you get in a fight with a family member, and you know you love them, but you just, I can't be close to you right now. And she was the one who said, a spy whose allegiance is you can't trust. He didn't quite excuse those words, but he said, I just can't be with someone like that. So then she's, of course, like, well, how are you being with a spy with Janet? It makes so much sense from her point of view. But from Aram's point of view, don't forget, he shot that missile, he's depressed, they're not really talking. He's smoking weed. And Janet did something very key. Janet did something very key at the end of the architect. She looked at Aram, he said, thank you for saving my life, but doesn't forgive you, we're cool. She goes, Aram, I'm sorry. Now, I'm sorry goes a long way with a guy like Aram. So he's like, oh, okay, we're cool then. So I think Samar is still his imagined love interest, but he just doesn't know how to deal with her and deal with himself. And I think the lease is more relaxed. Like, they've already been intimate. And they're like, you know, when you get in a huge fight, and I don't know if you've ever hooked up with an ex-girlfriend or your ex-boyfriend, it's just like, ah, it's out there. It's like, there's weed. What am I talking about? So I think that that's why he just kind of is engaging in a fling that's turning into something more serious. Yeah, okay. John, that's exactly what you were thinking, right?
That's exactly what I was thinking. But you can see how I can, a phone call can very easily, I mean this all seriousness, I can call and be like, okay, does this feel real? Does this not? You know, the actors on our show are very good and are very in it, and their radar will sound if something feels not true.
Troy, did you want to do the trivia?
Yes, the trivia.
Apparently we're supposed to do some trivia with you guys, so.
Oh my god.
Oh, what is this? Grab a microphone, you're doing this.
So, who here listens to the Blacklist Exposed podcast? Thank you so much for listening. You all will now, because we just put up our episode this morning, it's fantastic. So I am Troy Meinertz. I got to run in here late.
Plug in yourself.
So, what I'd love to know, is Nancy here? Where is Nancy, did she make it? Come on up, Nancy. You get to sit in chair number one down there next to John.
Oh, nice.
Okay, now for everybody else in the room, who here drove more than 5 hours to be here for the panel today?
For this panel.
For this panel. 5 hours. Stand on up. Stand on up.
Yes.
5 hours. Stand up.
Three people.
Three people.
That's
commitment, though. So how many of those five people?
Flying now?
Yeah, flying counts. More than 5 hours from Chicago.
I flew
from Chicago. Okay, how many people standing? How many people? Six or more. Six or more. Seven or more? Eight or more?
Where'd you fly from?
I'm from South Texas.
Woo! Allie, come on up. You get this chair. Congratulations. So we're going to do a little, it is a fan, podcast fan panel here at C2E2. Thank you so much for everybody coming out. We're going to put you in the spot, John, and Cass, and the fans. We're going to see who actually knows the show better in showrunner versus cast versus fans, everybody. Give them a round of applause. In front of you on the table there is a red and a black piece of paper. To represent the C2E2 colors, of course, not the black, no, I'm just kidding, but the blackest colors. So we're going to go season by season here, five questions, season one, season two, season three, season four. And if you go black for false, just hold up your black card, or red for true, just hold up your red card. Very simple. Ready? We're going to make this quick. And you guys can help out John and Amir and Susan, because I think our esteemed fans are going to be able to get this. So here we go. Season one. Tom Keene makes pancakes for breakfast. True or false?
True.
Fantastic. All right, stroganoff scene. The banker's wife is placed in a closet. True. Don't look at John's paper. 04-2983 for Mujing is actually Elizabeth's birthday.
Well, it's Megan's birthday.
Oh, so it would be false. False.
Oh,
I did. It's a true or false game.
Come on, I can answer.
There are a total of five Pavlovich brothers. Five Pavlovich brothers.
I believe there's
false.
Four.
There are four, correct. False is the correct answer. Again. Berlin cuts off his left hand
to
escape.
Hold on, don't answer. Don't answer. Lexical ambiguity was what Ron said. Don't do it. His left hand is right hand.
One answer.
That's true.
We got competing. Here we go.
He really needed a hand. He had a hook. He was on the phone hand. This way.
Help him out. Right or left, people?
Let's see.
It is his left hand. Left hand is a true answer. All right.
That's deep trivia.
Harbor Master's name is Gene. Season two. Yes or no? False is correct. It is Eugene. Dembe. Dembe speaks four languages fluently. True or false? True is correct.
Dembe speaks seven, Mike.
John said he spoke four, so I believe John. Cooper suffers from a glioblastoma.
Well, not for real.
Not for real. Yes, there we go. John's getting it. Red threatens to cut out Jasper's forked tongue. True or false?
Very true.
All right. And finally, Red gathers 12 of the best investigative journalists up to expose the fulcrum.
Doesn't sound good. It's
got to
be
11.
No, it's
false.
Like I said.
Season 3, Marvin Gerard and his lady friend go to a banana plantation in Fiji.
For sure. Somewhere else.
Amir is correct. It is false.
Yeah,
they
actually go to
Tahiti.
Yeah.
Or bananas. Everybody should experience tea time with Jilly at least once in their life.
I think that's right. She was in 308. She was the...
Are you sure you want to experience tea time with Jillian? Do you guys want to experience tea time with Jillian?
Yeah.
You don't want to get gay. You don't want to get stabbed in the neck with a dolphin. Yeah.
No.
Red wants the church to switch to burgundy wine for communion.
That sounds right.
That is true. Very good. Red uses the name Connolly to the police officer at Cape May. Amir is the best true or false player ever. You did well at school, didn't you?
No.
Your mom and dad would be proud. It is false. It was Donnelly.
Yeah, I didn't become Donnelly, just Tom Connolly was a big bad of season two. There's no way he would homage
to him. All
right. Holy cow.
Just married getaway car belonged to Aram's grandfather. Yes! All right, current season four. There is a red bracelet in the coffee can Liz digs up. Yes. True or false? True. It is Red Reddington, after all.
One of those friendship bands.
Yeah. Yes. Mr. Kaplan was chained to the bed at her left ankle. True or false? Red had billions of dollars stolen from him surrounding his business opportunity with ships.
Billions sounds like a lot. That's probably right.
Millions.
I'm just kidding.
False. $200 million. $200 million. Cooper got Liz's badge back for her.
So. It was the president.
That is false. It was President Diaz. Yes.
Cooper yelled at Red, who forced him to go to Diaz to get it.
It's kind of like Dembe poisoning Red, but not really poisoning Red, because he didn't know it was poisoning the cup.
It's a Lexi point of view.
This is my true response. Finally, Annie's last name is indeed Kaplan. That is true. Annie Kaplan. Everybody watches it on Thursday, right? Yeah. Give these guys a round of applause if you watch it on Thursday. Fantastic.
I
want to
do, but what is Mr. Kaplan's real full name?
Oh. It's Kaplan. I'm like, do you know the middle name? That would be awesome. All right, thank you so much for playing, guys. Absolutely. We have a few more questions, and if you guys have questions in the audience, there's a microphone center of the room. Go ahead, you guys can start lining up, and we'll take some questions from you guys as well.
Thanks, guys. All right, John, let's talk about Raylan Reddington and James Spader's portrayal. Every actor approaches the material their own way. How involved does Spader get with shaping story and dialogue, and is there anything you think Red could do that would be too far?
Well, I talked to James a lot. I mean, he definitely has opinions about the character and has certainly helped shape the character. Most specifically, I think, with the sense of humor. I mean, he's got a very weird sense of humor and is great. That's what's great, you know, and some of the things that make me crack up, in Eisendrath, and that's one of the joys of the show is to be able to come up with fun. There's not something that I ever really saw in the character. I thought he was very sort of serious and business as usual. So yes, he is involved. And there was another part to that.
Is there anything that would be too far?
Oh, well, yeah, definitely. And I think we've changed some stories because of that. Again, like I say, in occasionally speaking to the actors, they have very specific opinions and thoughts about who the character is. And even in the way that he dealt with Mr. Kaplan was something that we talked about a lot, you know. It's hard. It's like, how far can that character go? What can he recover from? And so, yes, we talk about that a lot. And there are a number of things that we haven't done. I can't think of anything specifically, but I know there's because they're always a pain in the ass because we have to come up with something else, you know. So when it doesn't work, when we need to come up with another term.
There's two things about I always thought it was really, really interesting in the show. First of all, the second he shot Kaplan was like,
just so you know, I had no input on
I always thought it was interesting because Red's a pretty good shot, and he basically went to the left side of her face a little bit and was like a little bit off, and then he said something like maybe subconsciously he couldn't really do it. I just thought that was so complicated and interesting because when he goes over the edge,
he feels terrible about it. You can see it in the episode that aired Thursday. He's as close to tears as we've seen, right? He hates himself for having done this. And he hates violence. He said that in the episode. He abhors violence. But it's part of who he is. So, and it is a delicate line. Usually, we throw that away and we just decide he can do whatever he wants because he's a bad guy, you know? But there are the occasional thing, the occasional moments where we go, let's not do that.
Oh, secret meeting.
This is true. Not Tom, but I spoke about this before. I think with Dembe, there was a moment where it's funny. There's a moment where Dembe, all the characters I think have died a couple times, probably in different versions of the scripts. But there was a moment early where Dembe died, and that was a place where James had a very specific feelings about it. And it made us sort of reflect on who the character was, and he was like, I don't think that can happen. I think this character is too important to him. We've had the same conversations about Mr. Kaplan and who they are to each other. And so that was a moment where we sort of, and again, these scripts are constantly evolving and changing and shifting until they're shot, and we're often doing rewrites as we're shooting. But that was a moment where Dembe may have not continued on.
Oh, yeah. Well, thank God for Spader then. All right, let's take our first audience question. Say your name and what's your question.
I'm Amanda. I came from Michigan. So first of all, I have to say, I've watched way too much TV in my life, and I think the pilot of The Blacklist is one of the best pilots ever made. Okay. So I'm so glad I can talk to you about it. My you're going
to
watch.
Wasn't it cool how last night they circled back to some of other angles, like watch them on angles of the pilot? And yeah, it's cool TV.
That's
fine.
But okay, so I think way too much about this, which is why you and I, right here, we could have hours-long conversations. All of us, but I think, you know. So I don't get why Red doesn't seem to care about finding his daughter. Whether Liz is his daughter or not, that's fine. But we know he has a legit daughter.
Jenna.
Right. And you know, the first season we saw him, supposedly every year he would go and watch Swan Lake. I haven't seen that in the past few years. He could be doing it, not where we see it. But I just, that has perplexed me. I don't know if you can give me any insight or if I just have to wait for next.
Well, I will say that is a loose end, and there are a number of them. And we keep track, believe me. There's a staff that literally, in fact, a couple of our interns are sticking around now, going through the scripts versus what aired. So even a little line like the cat instead of the turtle or something that might not change in the script, they're going through and rewriting the scripts as per what actually broadcast, so that becomes gospel.
Can
so,
I be an intern?
It's a tough commute from Michigan. So we do take that very seriously, and we keep track of all these loose ends and occasionally try to bring them together, and Jennifer is certainly one of them, and the relationship with Naomi Hyland, and I believe, if my memory serves me correct, Jennifer is in hiding and was away from Reddington and has no interest in being with him and sort of is in a version of protective custody. But one of the things that is difficult on the show is to have forward momentum versus going backwards. For example, in season 3, when Liz was on the run, it was a very present-day story. It was something that didn't require backstory. And I think sometimes we get mired in the backstory, and it's a very complex backstory. And so that's part of it. I mean, that's a little more of an Easter egg to me that's for a hardcore fan who remembers that. But to the average viewer who's checking in on Thursday night, it's not in the front of their mind. To me, that's something that, yes, we will eventually go through and tie together, but it's not like the burning question.
Okay, as long as we're going to get answers, I want to answer. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes,
state your name and who your favorite Blacklist character is outside of Raymond Red Redmondson.
You know, it's a toss up between these two because I was not kicked around out of bed for eating crackers, and but I'm so happy Mr. Kaplan is back. But really my question is for John. I'm Christy, I live 10 miles west of O'Hare Airport, so you know, pretty close to here. But I was wondering, you know, we know truth is stranger than fiction, especially sometimes what we see in television has mirrored what we've seen, you know, happen in real life. So I'm wondering, do you have any cooperation with federal agencies, or do some of them kind of, you know what, you got to cease and desist because you're a little too close to the truth?
No, we do have help. We have a tech advisor, Brad Garrett, who is a former FBI agent, who reads every script and comes in and says, yeah, that wouldn't happen. Or occasionally we go to him and say, hey, we have a transport of a criminal, and here's how it's going to happen. Would this work? So we do have help from him. We also have a research team where any writer kind of has, it's like therapy, you know. The writer can be like, okay, I'm trying to kill somebody with a poison that would not do this, but wouldn't do that, and it wouldn't show up for 12 hours, and then they go out and come up with like a bunch of links saying, all right, here's things that would work or would not work. We also have just a really smart staff. Luke Ryder, who's one of our writers, is a former attorney, and he is like a watchmaker with the law and the legal loopholes. So the way we took down the director, some stuff that's coming up, is very legally heavy. Rick Orsi's a guy who, you know, was in the sort of Alias family and is big into sort of sci-fi big alt things. And so all of that comes from, and they're all avid readers. So it is odd to me that, for example, we did an episode where Raymond Reddington stole a ton of money, I believe it was $300 million, from the next president of the United States, and it turns out that you know, there was Russian meddling in the election. Like, it is not lost on me that that happens. And I sort of somewhat believe in a cabal, like money over power. So I'm not completely conspiracy theory, but there is a, there's a lot of things that go into sort of grounding and hopefully making them feel real in terms of research and smart writers and just weird ideas.
Can I add to that? I just want to add, on set, there's a guy named James Bodner, who is a law enforcement consultant. So to make sure the wrestler holds the gun exactly right, how they take down people, even Iran was like, he's like, even how I would like get arrested or how I would, how, you know, Iran's been trained to use a gun in FBI training, even though he barely touches them. You know, exactly when the finger's here, especially when the camera was up close up on the director. I mean, he comes through, take exactly here. You got it. That's it. Next day, he's like, don't forget to use the finger. You know? We really do care about authenticity. I just want to give a shout out to Dave Metzger, one of the staff, you know, staff writers now, who does a lot of the research for Iran. And he makes sure, you know, he actually not just gets the technical correct and to make the technical accessible for sort of like the non-techies, but also he goes into hacker culture. So he makes sure that, you know, there's like Iran speaking himself or to his like, you know, foe friends and other agencies.
Right.
That's accurate.
Dave used to work at the Apple store, so it's all the questions about tech. And also, like, when I'm like, Dave, my startup disk says it's almost full. Thank you. So everyone has their little specialty.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, hi, I'm Judy Miller. I'm originally from Chicago, now Tucson. And I have a question, John, I don't know if you can answer, but I think everybody in this room is thinking this. When are we going to hear about renewal?
Oh, renewal.
Yeah, will there be a season 5?
Yeah, what's that?
Will there be a season 5?
Well, I certainly hope so. You know, truthfully, I don't think we're going to know anything until right before they have their upfronts, NBC upfronts, which is probably the second week in May. Yeah, but that's not a bad thing. Look, there's a lot of factors that go into why and what is picked up and when and how, and it's far more complex than I understand, but we don't have a pickup, but I'm not worried about that. I really am not. I have great faith in the show and in what we're doing, and you know, we'll see, but I would not panic.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
And I have a question that was sparked by an earlier comment about how the show has changed over the seasons. The very first season, we saw at the end of the season that Red went to this blacklister for this, to get this, to get this, to get this. And more recently, it's shifted more towards this blacklister to fix this immediate problem. Are we going to see maybe a return to the old overarching huge plot that Red has, or is it going to stay more closer to immediate needs?
Yeah, no, I understand. It's interesting. That's something that I think I've said on the podcast before. It's interesting. I feel like if we have standalone episodes, you know, and I love watching sort of the comment threads and Twitter and what fans are saying. It's my way to sort of interact with the show. It's like I can go to a theater and you know, watch like you would a movie. So so it's fun to hear that. And I find that, you know, we have a stretch where it becomes hyper-serialized and a lot of fans say, well, what happened with the case of the week? You know, and then we do a little run of the case of the week. The center of the season tends to become more case of the week. And a lot of fans go, well, wait, what about the, I want some big reveals. And so it's a hard balance to do that. We did do that in the first season, and we've had runs where we do that. Season 3, episode 1 through 8, really were about taking down the director. That happens in, it happened in season 4, actually, where if you go back and look at episode, actually 11 through 16, there are actually cases that were hits on, from, we now understand, Kaplan was going after them, going after his assets. So there is some of that connective tissue.
But it's more balanced going forward.
I think so, but you like that. You prefer
I
more.
Liked the first season. It was a huge reveal at the end, and I liked that aspect of it.
Yeah. All right, good to know. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure.
Hi, I'm Peyton. I have two short questions. One, I've always been curious, every episode is titled the 00 or whatever, you know, your number on the blacklist. Does that start at 000 or does that start at 001?
00, I think it starts at 001. I don't know, 000.
That was big when
that's intense.
On his home list.
All right, now you got me thinking. Yeah.
And then I was also curious if they're getting like a photo op with these activists. Or right now.
Sure.
They mean a lot of her in the hallway.
All right, sweet. Thank you.
Thank you. All
right. Did you have a question?
Had a curiosity question. Is Harry okay that he couldn't be here this weekend?
Oh, cool. Yeah, Harry had, he's fine, yes. He's, is he shooting?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, look, Harry's from Chicago. He wanted to be here. He was all about it, and just at the last minute couldn't make it. But yeah, thanks for asking. I'll let him
know. Did I have to do a Superman?
I have no idea. Maybe it did. That's cool.
That's amazing. Do you have a question?
Yes. Hi, I'm Mark, and I have a question, and I'm sure you'll answer it, and he will go on for about 10 minutes about it. Yeah. One, has no one ever heard of a blood test? Are you my father? Are you my father?
How do you know that she hasn't done one and already knows the answer? I'd say stay tuned.
And is there one person that's more, because I've seen other things with James Spader where he is a storyteller and some of his stories are just amazing and you have interactions with him. Is there like a whole staff that really writes his stories, or is he more in tune with a particular writer? Or like, where did some of these stories come from? Because they're really, really engaging. And does he ever ad-lib? Well, I know you said they don't ad-lib them, but as actors, are you just standing there listening to him going, is he just making this up as he
I'm sure you know he's not, because he's like, he'll go over it in the exact same way. I mean, it's, I watch the dailies, I'm really there, rarely there on set, but he is, it's fascinating to me, his ability. I can't remember, I asked twice, can you repeat the second half of that question? I can't remember anything. And it is fascinating to watch him do those speeches, because he just sort of sinks into it. He sort of just becomes it.
He'll hear if an actor opposite him uses a could instead of a would. And he'll be like, no, that's a could. I mean, he hears...
Yeah.
The most micro, he's micro specific.
Yeah, but in terms of where those come from, they all come from the writer's room, and we, you know, John Eisendrath and I spend a lot of late nights going through scenes. We take a pass on almost all the scripts, and oftentimes there will be a scene where it feels like exposition, where it feels like just cop stuff. It feels like he's going to shake somebody down, and we try to make ourselves laugh, or try to make ourselves. We tell a story. You know, there's a story about working and laying carpet. That was a story that John had. You know, a lot of it just comes from what surprises us, what makes us laugh. Once we start making each other laugh, a lot of the stuff with Glenn, usually that happens with us. But they, you know, it's also us. You know, we'll Google some weird island and be like, what is the hardest island for him to pronounce? You know, and what would be, I remember we did a thing about him finding, you know, he had, I think it was the end of season one, maybe, where he was talking about washing ashore, and he was rescued by some Mogan sea gypsies, and it just started, you're like, what are we even talking about? You try to really have fun with it and make it weird and fun, and he often has thoughts about it as well, obviously, in terms of the language and how it plays, and I can sit on the phone with James and he'll say, well, is it there or is it theirs? Ah, is it theirs? And then he'll maybe play it out, well, what do you think? Well, just listen to this, and then he'll say it, and I'm like, okay, I can't, there or theirs doesn't matter, whatever you think, you know, so there's a definite process that those scenes go through, but it is something, again, that's something that has changed since the beginning of the show. We didn't do a lot of that in the very beginning, and I wasn't somebody who watched the practice. I know we did a lot of that on practice, no. Foster Lingo, oh my god, I'm sorry. And I know that was his...
So hope he heard that.
Yeah. That was his staple, was sort of these big stump speeches, and once we realized, like, wait a minute, Spader's in the show. Why are we not writing this? We got to do more of this. And so that is something that has become a great joy to do. And is never really difficult, but is always weird and fun.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank
you so
thank
much.
Thank you. We have to wrap up the panel for the next one, so let's give a hand for...
Until next time, I'm Agent Troy Heinrichs. That's at Troy Heinrichs on Twitter. And if you want to learn more about me, just visit, well, about.me/Troy Heinrichs.
And I'm Agent Aaron Peterson. You can hear me talking about movies and TV on the Hollywood Outsider podcast, as well as Remake This Movie Right. We are available at thehollywoodoutsider.com or on Twitter at @H_Outsider. Be sure to subscribe, download the app, submit your feedback, but most importantly, keep yourself off of
the blacklist.
The Blacklist Exposed is a Golden Spiral Media production. Find more of our great podcasts at goldenspiralmedia.com/podcasts.